Disclaimer, this content is meant for information only and not as a diagnosis or medical treatment for any condition. If you or a loved one needs help, please seek out a qualified medical professional for assistance. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Katie Ostad, BSN, RN, IBCLC, and infant feeding specialist. Quench your thirst for knowledge and travel with me across the nation to discover, learn, collaborate, and better serve clients from all over the globe. Let's ride and thrive together. Today on the podcast, I have Dr. Liz Turner, who has been a general dentist for many years before discovering the link between oral restrictions, growth and development, and basically everything else in dentistry. Never in dental school or in practice did anyone talk about the tongue and its profound impact on the body. She is proud of her two babies, ages 5 and 3, who have been her why in her journey of discovering oral restrictions, sleep, growth, and impact that these three things have on the quality of life a human being can have. As a general restorative dentist with an airway focus, Dr. Turner has the opportunity to treat all ages, and in doing so is able to see the impact of untreated oral restrictions from womb to tomb. She specializes in cosmetic restorative dentistry with an airway focus always, as well as focusing on treatment of tethered oral tissues, interceptive orthodontic expansion, and preventative functional dentistry. Please welcome Dr. Turner to the podcast today. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today, Liz. I am so excited to talk to you. I know it's been a little tough with our schedules. You are one busy lady.
Yes, we've got a little bit of things going between two practices and two kids. And I do a lot of CE because that's what makes me happy. And we're just a busy time of year, that's for sure.
Yeah, that definitely is part of my language. I mean, I spend so much time on CEs. I think last year I renewed my IBCLC and we have to get 75 units every 5 years. And I had 65 units done in the first 3 months. And I was like, yep, that's, okay, maybe more than I need.
Yeah, we're at like 400 hours of CE right now for the last. It's just I don't keep track anymore, actually, right? Because it's really just a hobby at this point. Mm-hmm. And it's not for the checks and balances, but it is. It's nice because you network with people and you meet the right people and you can build relationships and those become friendships. And I feel really, really lucky to be in the space we're in now.
And there's so much more to learn. I mean, there's so many things that we're still constantly discovering in medicine and about the human body and how it functions and its amazingness of biology. I just, there's so much to learn. It's so fun. I just finished a really intensive functional med course and it was wonderful and so different and eye-opening, you know, such a different lens and way of looking at things than, you know, my nursing program or traditional medicine.
Totally. Yeah. That's the really interesting thing is everybody's ways they get into these spaces is so different. And that's where everybody's story is unique and everybody brings something to the table, you know?
Yeah. Would you like to share a little bit of how you came here, your little story?
Yeah. So I'm a general dentist. I had been practicing for about 7 years before my son was born and recognized fairly quickly that he was pretty fussy and didn't really know anything about babies and decided to reach out to a colleague of mine in New Hampshire who had seen post some stuff on social media. This was like early Instagram days. Seen her post some stuff on social media about laser, a light scalpel, some tongue ties, some babies. And I sent her a picture. And I know pictures aren't diagnostic, but you can tell fairly quickly from anatomy if it warrants further evaluation. And right, my son definitely did. So we had him treated with, because at the time we weren't really prepping babies, it didn't seem. And so we just treated him that day and no body work, no lactation support. And 3 days after that, my father-in-law had a heart attack due to years of undiagnosed sleep apnea and chronic AFib. And I'm just a dentist, but I started looking at his mouth and he survived, but he was in a medically induced coma for 6 days. And how much time does that take off of a life, right? Like that's so much stress. So speech impediment since the age of 4, bilateral crossbite, difficulty with breathing, all sorts of red flags that could have been caught early. And maybe we wouldn't have prevented a heart attack, but maybe it wouldn't have been so severe. Maybe you wouldn't have such severe sleep apnea. We got to look at the mouth. And so then I started to put the pieces together between infants and adults, and the whole thing just kind of snowballed. So I picked up, moved to Colorado after the new philosophies kind of set into place, and I realized the practice I was in wouldn't and couldn't support my visions. And I purchased the practice out in Colorado here, where I am now, just outside of Denver, kind of right bordering the foothills. And we have a general restorative practice with an airway focus. So everything we do is airway positive, including myofunctional therapy, tongue tie releases, in a colleague of mine calls them babes, littles and bigs. So infants, children, and adults. And we just try to make a difference one day at a time. And we're getting there, but there's so many people that need help and need treatment. And I only hope that the awareness can keep growing. And that's thanks to people like you. I mean, my lactation colleagues are some of our biggest supporters, and you're really like the first line of defense, right? That baby shows up, and if they can get into your arms, a lot of times we can catch something before it's a major, major issue.
Yeah, I mean, that's ideal, right? I think it's such a great thing when we can see them early, you know, and get in there nice and early and say, okay, let's prevent some of these problems that we know are going to come down the line if we continue on this path.
Totally. Right? That's the most important thing. I really just feel so grateful for the colleagues that I have that are helping these families navigate, because these things are difficult. And I tell families that I have the easiest job. You as the parents have the hardest job, and your functional providers, your body workers, that's where the magic happens. So a good release is absolutely important, and wound management is absolutely important, but the mechanics and the tension, those are the difference makers.
Yeah, I definitely think that it all has to come together. I like to say that, you know, the release should be the middle of the sandwich, right? Like, we should have body work and lactation pre and body work and lactation post, and that release right in the middle when we're ready. And sometimes it's not the exact middle, right? Sometimes it's a little earlier because we didn't have as much time to prep, or we do more prep and then we need very little afterwards. But it does make a huge difference when we have those pre and post.
For sure. And I tell families too, like, even having a baseline on what's going on, because I can do cursory functional assessments. I can understand the basics of mechanics, but when it comes to infant reflexes, where we are in the lifespan, what's going on with maternal supply, what are the maternal factors, all of those things need you guys. And I tell families all the time that even if it comes down to you only seeing them one time beforehand and one time after, at least we know they had a baseline on your child, so we knew we could go in the right direction. Because if you only see them after the release and nobody's really assessed them beforehand, how do you know what changes have actually been made? We're just going off, you know, some basics of symptoms. And if there's still lingering symptoms, then we're like, how bad were they to start? Like, where are we and where do we need to go?
Right. Yeah, that's a very good point that we need that initial. It's actually one of the things I do. I see a lot of my clients virtually, mostly for the last 3 years. I see very little in person with traveling life, but I have my clients usually send me videos, and I love videos because when we look together doing an exam, during a visit, it's so much more stressful. You know, the baby's crying, the parents can't hear you. It's a really stressful thing. And they, you know, even if I say, okay, do you see how this is, you know, the baby's tongue is doing this or it's doing that, they can't see it at the same time, right? Their baby's crying. It's like they've turned off. So they send me a video, and I actually just did one this morning for a client. I break it up. I take screenshots and then I write on them and I draw a little, you know, circle them and draw little arrows and show them exactly what I'm seeing in a very nice way of like a still photo where it's not going to move. And they can just look at it and go, oh, now I do notice that that lip is really tight, or, oh, now I can see that that tongue is really white, right? Like all these things that maybe they weren't able to notice before. And it's a really important thing. So even when I do an exam during the visit, I still like them to send me that, because that's our pre, that's our, where did we start from physically? Yeah. Like, what did it look like? What were, you know, where, you know, where was the tongue during crying? I like a picture of the baby crying because it shows me tongue in movement.
Yep, right? Exactly. Like, and I tell people that for active wound care too, like even if they're upset, they give you an opportunity to get under the tongue without being so forceful, and they allow some movement of that tongue where maybe they weren't moving it before. So yeah,
right.
It's we never want to see our babies cry, but sometimes it's to their benefit if they can react a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I always get my parents to start with the lip first if they had lip done as well, because I'd say then they usually do cry a little. They just kind of protest, and it will be easier to get under that tongue if they've started lifting it for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. We look at the whole thing as a system in our practice. And it's unfortunate because oftentimes I do see individuals coming from pediatricians, ENTs, and I know everyone's well-intentioned in their treatment, but sometimes they'll come to us and they'll say, I was referred to you, but I was told to 100% not let you touch the lip at all because it's not a problem. And I was like, well, who makes that determination? They're like, well, they said it's not. I said, well, do you see how shallow this latch is? Do you see how tight your baby's face is? Like, how do you expect this system to improve if we leave tension untreated? And not every lip warrants treatment, not every tongue warrants treatment. But if we're not assessing the whole picture and we're just making a generalization, oh, that doesn't exist, then how are we ever going to make progress? Because we're still going to have problems. So, yeah, it's really interesting how I find a lot, and what I've been saying a lot lately is, we didn't know what we didn't know 2 years, 5 years, 10 years ago. And now we do. So we can do better. But people are so unwilling to make change and accept these new paradigms in growth and development that it's almost like we're making a point and causing a fight just so we can be right. I see it in the orthodontic community. I see it in the speech community, the lactation community, the dental community. Like, none of us can accept that there may be things we missed in the past. And so it's easier to explain to parents that your provider isn't wrong. They just don't know. And they haven't heard these things before. They haven't seen them from this perspective. And I always encourage them to have their providers reach out, you know, afterwards. And we send reports with photographs and our initial assessments. And I mean, the photographs are always telling, because you take those mouths, you blow them up to 10 times their size. And it's easy to see what nobody was seeing when they weren't lifting the tongue up, because they never get in there and lift the tongue. So, and like, what pediatrician do you know is doing like a suck assessment on a baby? I don't know any, but yeah, I mean, I just feel so strongly about growth and development in relationship to tethered oral tissues. And that's what I tell families all the time. I want whatever you want for your breastfeeding journey. I recognize that everybody's situation is different. Everybody's goals and needs and wants and mental health are different. But at the end of the day, I want to see these swallow mechanics improve. And when we have breastfeeding mechanics and bottle feeding mechanics that improve, we at least know we're going in the right direction for positive growth. And if we can help the jaws grow in these first 2 years of life, and ultimately the first 6 years of life, when most growth is complete in the craniofacial complex, we have a child who is better set up for success. And setting these kiddos up for success with utilizing their own mechanics for growth and development is far less invasive by releasing tongue ties than in doing orthognathic surgery. Because a lot of these kids, I mean, they come back 11, 12, 13. Their growth is essentially complete. Their mechanics are poor. Orthodontically, we're moving teeth through the bones and we're not actually expanding them. And they're still sick. I mean, a lot of these kids have sleep disordered breathing. They have attention issues. They have so many manifestations of different health problems that come from this underdevelopment of the jaws. And sadly, a lot of their only option is surgical. So I think treat them early when there's problems. And so the symptom list is long, as you know. We look at everything from birth experience and position post-birth. Do they have a head turn preference? Were there hiccups in utero? I mean, there's things that people wouldn't even think are problems. So yeah, it's just interesting.
I mean, I definitely agree. And I think that I tell clients all the time too, it's the same thing. Your feeding journey is whatever you want it to be, hopefully, right? Because sometimes we don't get the option we want. And I respect that and try to support clients to, live with whatever options they have, because sometimes it doesn't work the way they want it to. But I always tell them, regardless of how you're going to feed your baby, even if you told me tomorrow you're switching to formula bottle, that is totally fine. I would still recommend the same treatment because I want your child to have a functional airway for their whole life. And that is something that is pretty crucial. Airway is pretty essential. And so that's the part where I feel like people sometimes don't get, when they're not in this space as much, some of the other providers, where I'm like, this isn't just about breast or bottle. This isn't just about breast milk or formula. This is about airway for life. And you have the opportunity to truly impact that shape and that development now. And that's going to change everything. And I tell parents too, when you affect airway and when you affect sleep, you affect everything else. There is no way that, you know, kids not doing well in school or acting out is not going to be related to the kid that's also not sleeping. Like, of course it's related. I'm not patient when I don't sleep. I'm not a patient, kind parent or partner if I get no sleep. Like, it just doesn't happen, right? I'm cranky and short with everybody. It's not a good thing. I need, like, I'm an 8-hour person every night and I need that
absolutely
sleep. And when you look at some of these kids who are so chronically sleep deprived, it's like, well, no wonder why they're acting out, right?
Totally.
They're not getting quality sleep. And even when they do sleep, they're not getting quality sleep. They're not breathing. And like, I did not realize that. I mean, I had been in this space for a couple of years, but I just, you know, I mean, being a mom, I put myself aside a lot anyways. And I just really hadn't thought about myself in the space at all until I had a light bulb moment last year when I was at Richard Baxter's actually. And I looked at the checklist for kids and adults and I went, my God, I have every one of those symptoms. And I was like,
that's the hard part, isn't it?
Right. I was like, this is like my childhood on a checklist.
Yep.
And
exactly.
I don't know. I mean, I can't prove it's related. It's also probably the only time I've ever heard of it, but I actually had grand mal seizures when I was a kid. I had,
oh my gosh,
incredibly enlarged tonsils and adenoids that there was a difference of opinion. My pediatrician felt my tonsils and adenoids were compressing my trachea and I would have a grand mal seizure to breathe when I was sleeping. My neurologist felt it wasn't. And I went, it was about 2 years of seizures before I had surgery. And my pediatrician finally said, we're just taking them out. So they took out my tonsils and adenoids and I never had another seizure.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, why were they enlarged in the first place? Why did I have massive tonsils and adenoids, right? Like, that's not normal. They shouldn't have been that big to begin with. And yep. I mean, you think back to all these symptoms. I mean, it's like everything from, you know, colic and difficulty breastfeeding. And like my mom said, I was the most unhappy child she's ever met in her life. Like I was just a miserable child.
So sad.
Right. I was that baby that cried 24/7.
Yep.
I know. And I think back, my mom was so young. She was 24 with two kids. And I'm like, oh God, my poor mom.
It's so hard, right?
Right.
Everybody's story is different.
Mm. Oh yeah. But it, just to think back and to think about the years I spent in speech. I mean, I think mm-hmm. I went to speech for like 8 years. And
oh
I'm
my
like,
gosh, it's so hard.
Right. And that's one of those things, like when I tell clients too, I tell them, you know, this is going to be a process. You know, if I meet someone who's got a 2 or 3 month old, I'm like, we're probably going to meet for really rough idea because every baby is different, but maybe 3 or 4 weeks before release and maybe 3 or 4 weeks after. It really just depends. Right. But I'll tell them it's not going to be forever. I promise. And mm-hmm. it's always in the back of my head of like, why is speech always like that? Like, why are some things still not being, I mean, even my youngest went to speech for almost three years before we moved. And then the new like evaluator and everything was like, she doesn't need to go. But why do we do something so endlessly without seeing results and without questioning why?
Exactly. That's the hardest thing is we can argue about the causes of things all the time. But at the end of the day, we're just trying to find solutions for families. And if you're not making progress, there has to be a reason why. Like, we're not looking at the root cause of things and the kind of basics of things as frequently as we should. We're just following a checklist. And
right.
That's really hard to see for families. And it's hard to hear as a parent who's had kiddos in speech for so long, or has, I had a kiddo yesterday we treated, she has aggressive scoliosis and she mm-hmm. has been in speech for 6 years since she's seven. She's been in speech since she was 1 year old and nobody caught. I mean, this one was, it wasn't even a submucosal restriction. It was a very obvious influence on some of the things. And maybe she was going to end up with scoliosis anyways, but if we could have provided her a little bit more spinal stability, would she be so bad at 7 years old? That's right. The hardest thing for me is like, these are little kids mm-hmm. for the most part. And that's where we should be starting. And when we're not starting early, or if we're withholding something early, what's going to happen 20, 30 years from now? So it's just the health implications of this stuff long-term are really sad to see. So I'm just optimistic that as our communities grow, and as I think the biggest thing is families are looking for answers. We're finally questioning the medical system and some of the answers we've been given as maybe there's alternatives. And it's not often uncommon that I'll see families who've seen 4 or 5 other providers, whether it be ENTs, dentists, pediatricians, and then they'll find like a mom group on Facebook and they'll end up in our office because of a community of parents who have looked further and are willing to share their stories. And that's what I tell people all the time. The best thing you can do for us is leave us some insight on our website. And it's not a review so people come to our office. It's a review so people read their stories and they hear the successes, or maybe they see something that lines up with the symptoms they've experienced, and we're able to at least assess and evaluate, which I think has been missed. And then families have information on what they want to do. Because at the end of the day, not everyone needs a tongue tie release and not everybody chooses to have one. But if we could at least give them the option and the information, then maybe 3-4 years, if they're still having issues and they weren't ready to do it then, they can address it later instead of just leaving it untreated. So it's hard. It's a hard conversation to have often with families. But at the end of the day, I feel really grateful to be in this space. And again, I'm so thankful for continuing education just because I feel like I finally found my people and the people who understand the uphill battle that we fight. And it's nice to be able to offer support when others are facing uphill battles or critique or criticism about the way we do things. And it's just nice to know you're not alone as a provider. It's hard, you know, you face that too, especially coming from the hospital where you have a nursing background. And I oftentimes find that hospital IBCLCs, once you start to think differently, you're kind of like a lone wolf and an enigma, and nobody knows how to manage you. And there's these gag orders in some hospitals, and it's challenging. I mean, you guys got to fight hard for what you see and what you believe. And so I applaud those.
Yeah. I mean, hospitals have a very developed routine and rhythm and protocol and system. And many of them are not really that easily changed. Yeah, I was actually just having a discussion this morning with some of their IBCLCs about why NICUs feed every 3 hours and how strict they are on that, even for everything from micro preemies to full-term jaundice babies. Like, their three-hour routine is like as entrenched as anything else is in the NICU. Like, it is.
That's so wild.
Right? And I'm like, but they're not doing cue-based feedings. They're not doing on-demand. Like, we're doing all this teaching about, you know, breastfeeding and all this stuff. And it's so, but it's so entrenched. And I don't, it is, that is the standard. That is the NICU standard pretty much all over the country. And it's so interesting how things get so developed and really resistant to change. And I think part of it is sometimes that they get comfortable, right? And they're expected and you know what's going to happen with them and everything else. And there's definitely hospitals out there where you cannot say tongue tie. And
it's funny. Yeah, we get
anything.
We get like hallway referrals more recently from, there's one very large hospital in town that has a very strong stance on these things. And we've started getting referrals from their pediatricians and from their lactation consultants, but it's not a formal referral. It's somebody stopped me in the hallway and gave me your information. And it's so sad,
right?
That this is how we have to operate, you know, but it's reality, but it's also good because that's how change gets made, right? So these babies can do well, they can go back, they can see the differences that these things have made. And it's just interesting how we're all evolving, and it's all happening very quickly, which is good. I mean, I think COVID brought a lot of awareness to people that maybe our medical system either wasn't accessible or maybe it failed us in certain ways, and starting to look more at preventative medicine as an option versus what's the medication I can take for this. So,
yeah, I mean, you mentioned it earlier, but I think root cause is just the most important thing that as we shift in medicine, I'd love to see that become so central, because it addresses everything from, it does address tongue tie, but it also, that's the whole point of functional medicine or naturopathic medicine. Like, there's too often that we aren't trying to understand why. It's like, we're not curious anymore. And we don't ask why things are happening. You know, I had a client the other day that the baby was spitting up a lot, and we talked about aerophagia and tongue tie and all of this. And they went to the pediatrician and they got prescribed Pepcid. And I'm like, okay, these meds have real risks. Honest, I'm serious always, risks that are, they're not even FDA approved for babies under a year. And
I ask, did anybody talk to you about the risks? And they say no. And
right.
So then we discuss the risks, and the little like lights go off in their heads, and it's hard to see. But yeah, and then yeah. I try to reference as much research as I can. And then mm-hmm. I also lay out that this is a difficult thing to get research on because we can't withhold beneficial treatment. And it's hard to standardize these things because they're so multifactorial. And I see that a lot with speech too. Like everybody's age is different. Their presentation is different. Their shape is different. So how do we standardize like what's affecting and what's improving? And I think a lot of it's like case studies and just recognizing the basic mechanics that go along with speech and feeding. But yeah, that's where we try to be as evidence-based as we can. And I quote a lot of literature. I have a lot of literature on our wall, and I have a lot in my brain that I can just kind of spit out because there are times where a family comes in and mom's on board and dad's not, mm-hmm. or vice versa. And being able to substantiate some of the longer term effects. And I just say, I don't have a magic wand. I can't guarantee that all of your symptoms are 100% associated with this. But when we look at the literature that supports jaw growth and the literature that supports the health that comes along with proper jaw growth, these are X, Y, and Z, the things that I would expect you may face some challenges with. And once they hear those things, it validates them a little bit more in making the decision. Because as you see so often, moms are quick to be like, I don't care. I don't worry about my pain. It's mm-hmm. it's about the baby. And helping them understand how uncomfortable their baby often is helpful. But also looking at the long term can just give them the little peace of mind that they're doing the right thing. And hopefully their pain will go down as a positive side effect. So it's tough. I mean, everybody wants the best for their child, and these are stressful things. And so,
yeah, I think the studies you were talking about, I think one of the crucial things about studies is that to do a study, you're treating everyone the same, right? And mm-hmm. we're not addressing the fact that our causes may be different. For example, like mm-hmm. that's one of the things that blew my mind in the functional med course was things like anxiety. Anxiety can yep. be a symptom from low vitamin D or an MTHR mutation or like an omega-3 deficiency or a leaky gut. Like there's a ton of reasons that you can have the symptom of anxiety. And if you take all yes. of those people and you treat them with the same antidepressants, well, you can see why it's actually not that effective, right? Like that's mm-hmm. part of why our med effective rate is not great. Some classes have better rates than others, but a lot of the antidepressants are still at like 50, 60%. Totally. And it's part of why when people struggle with like anxiety, for example, a lot of them will go through 3, 4, 5 meds before they find any relief because we're not really looking at their underlying condition. We're not mm-hmm. trying to figure out why. And that's the hard part about studies is because the idea of a study is to take 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 people and treat them all the same, but yeah. we're not all the same. And so what we totally. Really need is more case studies and more, or trying to group them and trying to say, okay, well, we've got, you know, 1,000 people with anxiety and it looks like 200 of them have MTHFR. Let's take those 200 and do something with them and figure out what's going on, right? Like,
yep.
I think that we need to start understanding that we are not all the same. And it's that there are so many different causes for things and we need to be so much more curious. I think that's really the thing that I tell people all the time is we need to be really curious. We need to mm-hmm. ask,
that's a good point.
Why are these things happening, right? Why is your baby struggling with feeding, right? Not just, okay, it is, give it a bottle. How about why? Yep. Feeding yep. is, you know, like my client the other day was blown away when I said this. I said, breastfeeding is supposed to be as easy as breathing. If your baby couldn't breathe, it would be an emergency, right? And the doctors would look at it and everything else. Breastfeeding is as essential to survival as breathing. So how are we having all these babies that are coming out that literally cannot breastfeed? Mm-hmm. And I'm mm-hmm. like, this is an issue. This is something we should be addressing and helping them get functional in, not just handing them a bottle. But again, we have people who are struggling to breathe and we hand them a CPAP. So yep. it's kind of the way we do it in this country. And we're much more Band-Aid and symptomatic treatment than root cause, unfortunately. Yep.
And that's the hard thing. And that's, I think, to your point with there could be so many reasons for anxiety. We all are in our kind of little spaces. And because these things are so multifactorial, how do you get everybody in a room and design studies that are going to right. be valid and accepted? And I have to applaud the Breathe Institute, Dr. Zaghi and his team out in LA, because they really have a standardized outline of research projects that they're putting together, and they have that mapped over the next 5 years or so. So, but there's only so much that one institution can do. So it really will require individuals in the speech community and the lactation community. But then for every two steps forward, we take a step back. I mean, there's the American Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine position paper, which is their white paper. And it's based on a position and basically an opinion that ties are over-treated, buccal ties don't exist, lips are not really a thing. And it's, we have these, again, people that just want to be right and aren't really looking at the big picture. So, you know, I think sometimes it's hard to just keep your head down and do the best you can, but that's what I really strive to do all the time. I know you wanted to talk about optimal timing for release, and I can kind of go over how our practice in our office works
to mitigate
some of these risks. My team is pretty well trained in fielding phone calls to know where referrals are coming from. And in order to schedule, there are times where I'll do same day treatment because these things, again, are time sensitive. Not everybody has the time, the means, the ability to travel across town or fly to see us. And if they've done proper preparation with the right people, I feel comfortable providing same day services. So to schedule in our office for a longer appointment where same day release could happen, we really request that everybody's gone through a functional provider and has done oral exercises to improve mechanics and have a baseline on the function, as well as having body work in some capacity. And I use that as a blanket term, which is sometimes incorrect, because I think that there are certain modalities that are really good at it, but not everybody in the space is. So chiropractic, osteopathy, craniosacral therapy, physical therapy, all of these individuals serve the population if their training is in the right space. And so if we can kit people to go through those two avenues before they come into our office, we know that they've kind of checked our boxes for success, and we have a backup plan if things aren't going 100% in the right direction. Is it a body tension issue? Is it an oral tone issue? Where do we need to go from here? And it's really a team approach. So for individuals who haven't done those steps, I just feel that in informed consent, people need to be told what and why the recommendations are being given. So my thought process on informed consent is, if they choose to not do the body work, if they choose to not see the IBCLC, I want them to understand what the risks are and why they increase in terms of reattachment, poor outcomes, not optimal improvement, things like that. And I like to have that conversation in person, or we do a lot of virtual consults as well, just so families don't have to travel if they don't need to. They can check our boxes for success and then come and be assessed for the procedure. So I try to have them see their functional provider and their body worker before and after. And then I tell them that relationship will continue if it needs to, and based on the assessments of those people.
We try to do a 4 to 7 day follow-up to catch healing in its earliest stages and reevaluate how they're doing the aftercare, and also make sure that things are continuing to go in the right direction. Normally day 5, 6 is where there's a turning point in our practice, and the discomfort with the stretches, things are starting to go in the right direction. And of course, not everything's fully resolved at that stage, right? They're just gone through a surgical procedure. They're regaining function. There's so many layers, but I just try to do an early follow-up to reduce the risk of reattachment, and then be able to communicate with our other team members, body workers, and functional, how things are going, or if I have concerns over the healing. And that seems to work pretty well.
Do you see them again after that?
If needed, I have a lot of families that travel, and I know that the people I'm working with are all well-trained in assessing for what healing should be. And if things are going in the right direction, I wouldn't be recommending another release, right? So I don't want to waste anyone's time, mine or the family's, in requiring them to come back. I do offer follow-ups. I tell people the next time I see you would generally be at 30 days, because we've already assessed how you're doing the wound care. We know you're doing it correctly. This is our protocol for how to do it. And we need to get through some other phases of healing, including the 21-day contraction phase. so that I have an idea, because it looks different at 21 than it does at 30. And a lot of times there's contraction at 21, people call panicked that it's reattached. And I tell them to just keep stretching, get through the contraction phase. And by 7 days later, everything is in good shape. So mm-hmm. I really like to see them at day 30 if they need to see me or they want to have the healing evaluated.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I like to see mine. I typically see my clients 2 to 4 days afterwards. I used to see them the day after, and then I realized that it was no good. Like, no one could hear me the day after. And I now just have them, and I usually will prep them and say, okay, like, plan nothing for tomorrow. If you can order out dinner, or, you know, have your partner cook, or put something in the freezer, like, plan a really easy day. You know, get support if you have older kids, like whatever you can do so you can plan to just kind of skin to skin, hang out, keep things as easy as possible for a day, because usually that next day everyone is just cranky and I find emotionally friable. Like, they're just kind of done. And then the next day things will start to sit in. So usually like 2 or 3 days later is like my ideal. I'll go for, it just depends upon the family and everything. And occasionally, like, I had a client recently who was like, I want to see you the next day. She's like, I'm just so scared. I was like, of course, you know, so sometimes we do things differently, but typically I will see them soon after because I also want to watch them do those wound care. Right. And we've gone over it a lot. We've practiced, but it's a whole different thing to practice and then to actually do it when there's a wound there, right? It's scary for those parents and everything. And they're worried about hurting the baby and they're worried about reattaching if they don't do it right. And so they've got a lot of stress. And so, I typically will see them and say, okay, let's practice this together. And again, and I do a lot of videos and stuff too.
Yep. And most of my providers that I work with are in that same camp where they'll be seeing them anywhere from 3 to 7 days post. And then again, at 2 weeks or so. And that's where I don't feel a need to see them, provided things are continuing to go in the right direction, because all I'm going to do is a stretch. And I tell people, you can always call us and ask me to do a stretch, but I'm not going to require that you come across town so that you can tell me about how the function's going when I don't really have great answers for you. Your functional provider is going to be the one that has the answers for you on how the mechanics, because I can assess, right? But I don't feel it's within my scope to have a baby at breast and tell you how to adjust the latch. I mean, I'm a breastfeeding mother, so I know enough to be more than dangerous. And I've worked in this space for enough time that I probably know more than I give to patients. But I also feel like it's doing you guys a disservice if I misspeak, and that's truly your scope, not mine. So, and it's sad at times where I think, oh my goodness, these IBCLCs with this level of training should be able to diagnose. The fact that they have to say, I'm pretty positive, but I can't say with certainty, is just silly to me, when others that are so untrained in the space can confidently diagnose yes or no. So I have problems with that, but
yeah, the wording,
I just try to stand behind my individual, I stand behind my functional provider so much. And I just try to put as much, I guess, credibility into their assessments as I possibly can. So, but it's hard, you know, because not everybody has endless time or finances. So we spend a lot of time navigating systems and how to get people into the right spot where they could potentially obtain some billing assistance, or do they take this insurance, or do we really just need to step outside of the insurance network and work with this individual because I think they can best manage this case. There's so many layers. Definitely. So we spend a lot of time, we call it quarterbacking treatment, quarterbacking referrals. And we do that a lot for adults and older children as well. Where do you go next? Do you need to go to ENT? Do you need to go to orthodontics? Do you need to have a sleep MD evaluate you for temporary CPAP? Do we want to send you to the oral surgeon? What are your goals for treatment as well? And so, because that's the same with babies, like, what are the goals? What are we trying to accomplish? And we look at that in adults and children too. What are our goals? What are we trying to accomplish? Because what's right for someone may not be right for everyone.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that it is frustrating that I can't diagnose. I will tell people too. I'll tell clients, I can't legally diagnose a tongue tie, but what I see is functional restriction. I see, you know, these are the anatomical things I see. These are the functional things I see at the breast. This is how I see it's not doing well. And, you know, we'll talk through the whole thing. But it is an annoying, weird little thing where you're right. Those that assess the function, which is what we should go off of more than anatomy, aren't allowed to diagnose. And those who assess the anatomy are, it is just the way it is at the moment, right? I think part of it is that IBCLC is a newer profession. And while it has been around, you know, helping women breastfeed has been around, you know, from the beginning of time, but as a profession, it's fairly young and new. And so I think the, you know, that's something for the IBCLE to work on, but it's also, it's an international license. And so but sometimes I maybe don't see the whole picture, right? Because I'm looking at it from a US point of view, and that's my own bias, but they are, you know, hopefully working to advocate for lactation all across the world and lactation providers to be, you know, seen as educated professionals.
For sure. You know, and your guys' level amount of education that you guys put into this is so incredible. And when I try to, because they're like, well, why can't I just see the person at the hospital? And no discredit to CLCs, but I mean, that's what, a 2-day course most often. The amount of training that you guys have done to obtain that credential is so incredible. And I basically say it's like they worked for 2 years unpaid just so they could teach you how to breastfeed your baby better. And I just try to put it in that, like, could you imagine not working for 2 years only and doing your job for free only so you could help somebody do something better? Like, that's so selfless. And I think when they hear that, they're like, oh, wow, that's like way different.
Oh, that's very sweet. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a labor of love. I think so many of us have come into this because of our own experiences or because of a real passion to help moms and babies. I mean, I've been a nurse for 23 years and always worked in maternal infant medicine. I did labor and delivery. I did NICU. I did postpartum. You know, I have always worked with moms and babies. It is what I have done and where my love is, because there's something amazing and special about a new family being born. And every time a baby's born, the family changes and grows and develops. And it's amazing to be able to support them and be part of it, you know, for that moment and help their journey. So I feel blessed to do what I do. But yeah, it is frustrating. I was actually, someone suggested that I reach out to another tongue-tied provider yesterday, and I looked at their website and they've got CBSs, the Certified Breastfeeding Specialists. And not that they don't have a place. I think that they do. And I think that, you know, if a pediatrician's office were to have a CBS, I'd be like, great, get some basic breastfeeding education out there for every family. That's wonderful. But when you're talking about high-risk tongue-tied families, there's no place for a CBS in that. Like it's just not appropriate. That's not the level that somebody needs when they're dealing with a tongue tie. And
absolutely,
seeing that kind of thing, it was like, well, maybe that's not the provider that I reach out to today, because we may not be on the same page, right? Like I think that is a definite issue. And I also wanted to comment too on the body work when you had said earlier that it depends. And I think you could say that about all of our professions, right? Like, not all dentists are airway and tongue tie savvy, and not all lactation consultants are either. I mean, there are definitely lactation consultants I've come across that know nothing about ties, and it's
for sure
astounding.
Yeah. And as a dentist, there are certain things that people do way better than me, and I'm happy to refer those to the experts. I mean, root canals, dentures, implants. There's so many things that I don't manage in my practice.
Oh, yeah.
And it's funny. I think in our profession as dentists, like, we're general dentists and our scope of practice is what we're trained in. And we could be trained in any number of things. This is what I'm trained very, very well in. And this is what I feel really confident discussing with patients. And I feel like we manage these to the best of our ability. Whereas there's something like a badge of honor if you do more of every single procedure. And it's like, we don't need to be experts in all the things. Like, be okay with saying there's somebody that's better than me at this. And I feel comfortable in my space saying that I feel like I'm one of the better people at this. And there are so many that are better at it. But think of how many dentists there are. There are so many mouths that need to be treated, and not all of them need this specialty procedure. Not everybody needs an implant. Not everybody needs a root canal. Not everybody needs a gum graft. So we send them to the specialists who can best manage those situations. And also the risks that come with it. Like, there's risks of treatment, right? Nerves, vessels, salivary glands, bleeding, no improvement, weight loss, all sorts of things. And so to be able to answer those questions and field those concerns for a family, I think, is really important. You have to be accessible.
Absolutely. I say the same thing. I'm like, I don't do inducing lactation, or I haven't had any chest feeding clients. It's not that I wouldn't love to learn it, but I haven't embarked in that yet. And I know so many people who are so much better qualified at it than me, right? I don't
totally
help someone induce lactation for whether it's, you know, their partner's birthing the baby or adoption. I've had maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 sets of twins in 5 years, and 2 of those were very good friends. Like, I don't do multiples. And it's just not my thing, but I know people who are great at it. But if you're coming to me with like low supply, with tongue tie, with, you know, gut health issues, with allergy stuff, with baby and mom, that's my space. And like, I am passionate about those things. And it shows in the education, the time and the reading and all the things I will do. But I definitely agree that we should all say there are things that you shouldn't try to be good at everything. Like, and if you want to do a little bit of everything, you will still have to respect the fact that there's times in each of those spaces that someone's going to need more than your knowledge is, right?
And yeah, that's very true.
I just like I did have last year had a twin client, but it was tongue tie babies. And we did discuss the fact, and I told the client, I said, I don't really do twins. I said, I do tongue tie. I said, but if you want me to help you find someone who does twins and tongue tie really well, I'm totally fine with that. And she was like, no, you're better with tongue tie. That's what I need. I've got the twin thing down. I was like, okay.
Okay, cool. Then we're good. But that's informed consent, right?
Like
you just, provided that person an opportunity to make a decision. And that's, I think, one thing that we see so much in like birth and hospitals and in raising children is everybody's got their opinion and they're not quick to offer that their opinion may not be right about something. So, and that's what I remember my doula telling me before my son was born. She's like, there's very few things that are true emergencies. Like you should have the right to have 5 minutes to think about the decisions that you make, and you should be able to be given multiple options. So do we induce you? Do we give you an epidural? Do we do this? And we can talk about the risk, benefits, and alternative and give you a minute to process that information. Right. So it's just trying to support people through the process. I think it's just one other way by offering them alternatives and letting them make a choice. So
And informed consent is something that unfortunately doesn't seem like it's necessarily getting done all the time. Throughout much of medicine, but especially in the birth world and everything. And it's, things are presented as you are 39 weeks. We need to induce you. This is what we're going to do. You're on the schedule. And it's presented as fact as opposed to opinion. And not that you're not going to, I wholeheartedly say when you pick a provider, hopefully you're picking someone whose knowledge and experience you respect and that you should look for their guidance. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't, but it's also totally appropriate to question their opinion as well, because no one knows you as well as you, right? And so they have a medical opinion based on their experience, what they've seen and stuff like that. But every experience is different. And there's too often that people are not given a true informed consent of risks. I mean, even things like, you know, prescribing Pepcid to the babies. It's like, did they sit down and talk to you about the risks of these? I mean, I've looked back over the years and there have been way too many times where I've looked back and do not feel like I was given consent, informed consent on stuff with my kiddos. And it's really unfortunate. I mean, my kids were on the, there was an allergy one that was recalled and I can't think of it now. Zantac. And my kiddos took it two pills, 3 days a week for allergy shots for 6 months.
Oh, wow.
And I was not really given any other option or told any risks. It was, they're reacting to the allergy shots. This is what we need to do. Give them 3 Zyrtec and 2 Zantac before the shots every day, which now that I say it out loud, I'm like, oh my God, what did I do? But at the time it was presented by these knowledgeable allergists who I was respecting. And, you know, I mean, it just, it's hard. It's hard because sometimes we are really not given all the information. And to be fair, it's not like it wasn't recalled at the time and the allergist didn't know that it was going to be recalled either, but there were known risks with it.
Totally.
And unfortunately, they're not always told.
Yeah, that's really hard. But yeah, that's what we run into a lot in our practice, is just trying to field information and provide people with the best services we can and get them to the right people for support. It's fun.
Yeah. And I think so much of tongue tie treatment, like you said, is so much more not preventative in the sense of we're trying to release everyone's tongue so that nobody gets a tongue tie, but preventative in the, okay, we have a functional loss here. If we treat it now, we're going to be able to hopefully allow for normal functional development and growth and facilitate good airway, good sleep, good growth and development, right? Like we can treat a problem early as opposed to waiting until what? The kid has sleep apnea and speech issues and behavioral issues and is miserable. Like, why do we wait to have bigger problems when there's already one and we can treat it now?
Exactly. Yeah, that's the hardest part, I think. But I think we're just all making the dent where we can. And I think we're making progress, which is good. Now we just have to keep going.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we just, you know, we do our best to work in our space. And then things like this, like podcasting, getting the word out. Instagram is huge because there's so many parents who are getting information on Instagram. You know, mm-hmm. I think that it's almost like crowdsourcing your support group, right? And they're getting support from other parents and from other providers and finding those that they can reach out to, like you and I are doing, going to classes and learning and conferences and networking and trying to grow this space as best as we can. And just keep doing and hope that the work itself will speak for what we're doing.
Yeah. And we're getting there. We're getting there. It's a slow process, though. That's for sure.
It is. But yeah, but it's pretty amazing.
Doing the best we can.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing to be part of. So I think it's really wonderful what you're doing in Denver. And I think families are so lucky to have you. And I've heard so many wonderful things about your office from my intern who's in Boulder. And it's just been really wonderful.
We try hard and, you know, there's some other wonderful providers in town. And I just always tell people too, if you need a second opinion, I would recommend you see one of these three people just because I know what their thought process is. And you may just like them better and go ahead, do it. I don't care. Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure that families are getting the right information. Because if they go somewhere else, they may be told something that I don't believe is true. And so it's also collaborating with others that are in the space that I think is important.
Yeah.
But the progress is being made and we're getting there.
And it's incredibly hard for new parents when they're already sleep deprived and struggling and scared and overwhelmed to hear such opposing points of views. And it's like, Dr. Gaheri did a Instagram reel on this the other day, and he was saying that it's like when, you know, you're a kid and your parents are fighting and you're like, who do I believe?
Yeah.
You know, and it's so overwhelming for these new parents going, who do I listen to? They both are saying opposite things and it's so hard. Mm-hmm. And that's when I hear that with clients, what I always go back to is who is talking to you about the why, right?
Yeah.
If your pediatrician says there's no tongue tie, fine. That's totally okay. What do they say in answer to all of your symptoms and baby's symptoms? And when they say, well, they just said to give a bottle, I said, that doesn't explain why the symptoms are there, right? So
yes, exactly.
I can disagree with another provider and that's fine. I think that can be really healthy and we can learn from each other. But there's a difference between disagreeing and being dismissive. And unfortunately, that's what a lot of families get is they get dismissed. Their symptoms, their problems are getting dismissed and not heard. And that's not okay. It is completely fine to have a difference of opinion and for them to say, no, I really think this is the cause. Let's try this instead. I can totally respect mm-hmm. that. But let's not be dismissive of families and what they're going through. And let's really try to support and find answers.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's the biggest message that we can try to get across is these can be multifactorial, but that doesn't mean that this isn't one of the factors. So right. And I tell people, we're looking at tongue tone, tongue tie, tongue space. Sometimes we have babies that have high vaulted palates, really high vaulted palates. Maybe they had a feeding tube in the NICU or something like that. And they just have more ground to make up for. And mm-hmm. that's okay. So, but this can still be considered a factor. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's just, we just keep on doing what we're doing, I guess.
Yes. So I want to thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. I know your time is so valuable. So thank you for taking that time to share your message and to help spread the knowledge.
Awesome. Well, thank you too. I really appreciate all you do. And I'm just so excited to be a guest. And I look forward to helping in any way I can. So if anybody has questions, I have an Instagram. It's Dr. Liz, L-I-Z-Z-Z-T. And we have a couple of practices here in Colorado, Fox Point Dental and Bloom Sleep and Airway. So I'm always open to questions and differing opinions and views, because I think that's where the magic happens is through the dialogue. So please feel free to reach out.
Absolutely. I will put that in the show notes. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And I guess we'll talk soon.
Sounds great. When you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change you. I hope that you enjoyed the podcast today and learned something new. If you know someone who would benefit from this podcast, please share.